Hey, good afternoon, and welcome to this this talk on the time preference theory of interest and its critics. If I were Tom Woods at this point, I would say this is obviously where all the cool kids have come. So leave those other loser types upstairs. But we've covered a lot of ground this week, and in this particular lecture, we want to take up a topic that we haven't explored in any depth, although it's been a part of the discussion of many different topics that you've already examined. So earlier in the week, we've covered the basic principles of human action, of ends and means, and the physical production processes, the capital structure, and the relationship technologically between different production processes, and we talked about valuation and the imputation of value and how this organizes, how the human mind organizes all of these different objective features of the world in such a way that preferences are satisfied. We talked about economic calculation, how this is done in society through the process of the market, so that entrepreneurs are able to make economizing decisions of the use of resources based upon our registering our preferences in the form of money relative to goods that we value. And yet we, haven't really discussed in any depth this question of time and the way in which we value our actions with respect to time. So that's what we're going to do in this hour. And we'll, of course, pay special attention to the implications that valuing time or valuing our action with respect to time has to do with interest. And then in the latter part of the talk, we'll address, as the title says, the critics of this theory. We'll look at some alternative theories of interest. So let's first just make a distinction between the two different ways in which we value our action with respect to time. Only one of these relates to interest. One way in which we value our action with respect to time, we might call the timing of our action. So we recognize that for at least some of our actions, the moment at which we decide to take the action will affect its value. So we could take exactly the same action at one moment in time or one day of the week or one month of the year or whatever it is and get a certain value from it, but we could take the same action with the same means at a different moment in time and get a different value. And naturally, because we economize as human beings, we tend to take account of this fact and, ceteris paribus, choose the timing of our action so that we get the greatest value from taking the action. So just a mundane example, my wife's birthday is coming up, August 18th. And I could have a birthday party for her on August 18th, and we'd get a certain value from this. And for those of you guys out there who aren't married, you'll find this out soon enough if you don't already. If you were to have your wife's birthday party on August 20th, 2 days late, it wouldn't have the same value, right? Because she'd be mad, you forgot my birthday, and she'd be all, upset about it. So, admittedly, there's some actions for which this wouldn't be the case. It wouldn't matter. Timing wouldn't matter. And in that instance, of course, we don't pay attention to that possibility. Now, this difference that exists, depending upon the timing of action, can manifest itself in the market. That's because the goods that we use as means to attain the ends that have different value for us at different moments in time, we will impute different value to them. So a birthday cake, to have a nice birthday cake for me on August 18th, would be worth more subjectively than having it on August 20th. So since this can happen, then in society, we can value a given good more highly at one moment in time than another moment in time. We can gain by arbitraging across this difference, right? By This is all human action does this, right? We forego a lesser valued option to obtain an option that has greater value to us. Now, we do this formally in markets. Most of you are following this already. You've anticipated my conclusion. We do this with forward transactions or futures markets. This is precisely what we're doing. We're taking account of the fact that in the future, oil may have a higher price because of increased scarcity or whatever it is. And therefore, we can trade today on the basis of our anticipations to exchange oil in the future, depending upon what our expectations are. And by doing this, we create a process of temporal allocation of the good. So if a lot of people thought that the price of oil would be $20 higher 6 months from today, they would engage in forward transactions today. They would agree today to trade oil at a higher price in the future, because that's what they anticipate will happen. And as soon as that forward price or future price emerges, say it's, again, $20 higher than today's price, people who own oil or who are producing oil will see that it's economizing to allocate the oil temporally. They'll hold on to the oil they have today and allocate it 6 months from today when its price is higher. And so this will bring the prices, the temporal difference in prices together. The more people, the greater supply will mitigate the anticipation that the price would be higher in the future. And this is the proper a way in which we would allocate the good temporally. Just like we would do the same thing geographically, right? If oil had a low price in Saudi Arabia and a higher price in Canada, then profit could be earned by arbitraging it from where its value is low to high. But as you arbitrage it, you bring the prices together. You supply more where the price is high, you demand more where the price is low, and the prices come together, and this improves human welfare, moving goods from where they're valued less to where they're valued more. So again, this is just a general principle that's applied now in our actions to time, this idea of timing. Now, the second way in which we value with respect to time, we call time preference. And this is the element of valuing with respect to time that leads to the rate of interest. And time preference has to do with intertemporal trade, not what I've called temporal placement of something. Where do we choose to conduct our action, or where do we choose to allocate a good in the stream of time? But intertemporal trade, when we trade present for future goods, or present for future satisfactions, if you will. Okay, so we define time preference this way. Time preference is the preference a person has to satisfy an end sooner as opposed to getting the same satisfaction later. You notice then the difference between these two elements. When we talked about the timing of action, we said for some of our actions, there will be a difference in the value of taking the action depending upon when we do it. When we talk about time preference, we have a ceteris paribus condition. We say, what if the value of taking a particular action were the same regardless of when we did it? Then would we value differently depending upon when it was done? And the answer is yes. We would value a given satisfaction sooner as opposed to later. Or the concrete manifestation of this, we prefer $1,000 in our hands right now as opposed to $1,000 of equal purchasing power a year from today. This is time preference that creates this. Now, the first point to make about time preference with respect to action is that this is a praxeological principle of acting. This is a fundamental conceptual part of acting. This isn't something that we could either do or not do. Just like preferring one thing to another is always an element in every action, time preference is also an element in every action that has an intertemporal dimension. Again, there may be actions that don't, but they would be rare, right? So time preference is not referring to some physiological property of human beings, the fact that we get tired or some psychological principle that we're impatient or something like this. Time preference exists regardless of the extent to which physiology is constructed in a particular way, or that our psychological disposition toward waiting is one way or another. Time preference is analogous to the principle that, again, we establish right away, and we see this right away, that this doesn't depend upon anything except our condition as human beings in the world. We prefer more to less. Once we've defined, you know, what a good is and the scarcity of goods, once we see that this is so, that we are in the condition where this must be so, it just follows automatically that we distinguish between more and less precisely because it's meaningful to us to make this distinction. We prefer more to less. This is because we're finite beings, because we face scarcity. Because we're temporal beings, we prefer sooner to later. We always do. There's no exception. It's just built into the nature of being temporal or being human. Okay, so this means, I stress this just to make the point that time preference will have to permeate all of our actions. So when we build in society a capital structure, or when Caruso on his island, you know, constructs a net and he starts to build a structure of capital, time preference must enter into the determination of how to proceed in building these steps of production. For every step that we take, mining iron out of the ground and then shipping it somewhere and producing steel and then making steel fenders for automobiles and then making the car, every intermediate action is subject to time preference. And depending upon the extent of our time preference, whether, as we say, we have low time preference and our preference for sooner over later is not very intense, or whether we have high time preference and our preference for sooner over later is very intense, it will dictate the extent to which we lengthen out production processes, in which we accept, in other words, a greater satisfaction later in time to a sooner satisfaction in the present. Now, let me point out a few things that are implied by time preference that besides interest. One is that it must be the case that if we choose longer production processes as opposed to shorter ones that are available to us, it must be the case that the longer ones we're anticipating will be more productive. Because, again, we have time preference, which urges us toward the shorter. So our example of Caruso, remember on Monday, he can try to catch fish in a stream on his island with his bare hands. And so this is a direct production process. But he's not very productive doing this. And so he's willing to save and invest to make a net, but only if he thinks that the longer production process, he has to go, you know, over the island and find vines and twine, and then he has to fashion the net, and then he can go fish. That longer process will pay off in terms of greater productivity. So longer production processes always give us something, some consumer good at the end of the process that we value more highly. Otherwise, again, we would never engage in the longer production processes. By the way, the corollary principle to this is that in any given situation of acting, or you know, like Caruso's been acting on his island for a while, or here we are in society and we've built up this gigantic capital structure, for any given situation that people find themselves in or brought about by their actions, it must be the case that only longer production processes are available to them. All the shortest, most productive production processes have already been adopted. Why? Because we're economizing beings. That's why. This is why, as you've heard about several times over the course of the week, when there's monetary inflation and credit expansion engendered by a central bank and fractional reserve banking system, it lengthens out the production processes. Why is this so? This must be so because we've already adopted all of the shortest, most productive production processes possible. That's just human nature to do this. This is what we do as human beings. And therefore, only longer, more productive production processes are available to us. And so it must be that when we extend the capital structure, we're lengthening out production processes. Now, let me also point out that except, you know, alleged exceptions that are sometimes made to time preference are, well, we could not find such a thing. They're entirely beside the, they sort of miss the point of what we're doing when we talk about time preference. And let me again, since it's a little harder to see this with time preference than it is preference, let me just explain this for preference. It's simpler. Preference, remember, is just the fact that in every action, we have alternatives. And so we always choose what we value more highly and we forego what we value less highly. This is always true in every action. And that's our preference, right? We prefer one thing and something else is less valuable to us. So you cannot contradict or provide a counterexample to preference. It just, there are no such things. One example that my undergraduate students commonly like to point out is something like this. It goes something like this. Well, what if you have Joe Camel here, and Joe Camel is dragging on a cigarette, and as he's taking a drag on a cigarette, he's saying to his friend, he's saying, "Oh, I hate smoking cigarettes. I wish I could kick this habit. This is awful." Now, is he doing something contrary to his preference? No, obviously not. People always act consistently with their preferences. This is just the way we use the word preference. The word preference just refers to the fact that a person has made a choice, and it must be the case because we're human beings that they value what they've chosen more than what they've given up. Because if they didn't, if they had a reverse valuation, they would have chosen the other alternative, but they didn't. You see, there can't be exceptions to this, right? Economic theory isn't about what people say with respect to their action. It's about explaining what they actually do. And so the same thing is true of time preference. There are no exceptions. You can't find exceptions. People who try to invent exceptions and say, hey, here's a case where there's no time preference, just don't quite understand what the concept of time preference is referring to. Now, the classic case of this, just to give you a concrete example, again, like the smoking case and preference, the classic illustration of this is, okay, we got this guy, it's in the winter time, and it's, you know, in Pennsylvania where I live, it's cold in the winter. It's not like down here. And this guy says to his friend, right now in the wintertime, ice, a bucket of ice is worth more to me in 6 months in the summer. And then people say, well, see, that contradicts time preference. You're not discounting the value of the 6 month from now ice, right? But you can see already that we've dealt with this objection, right? We've dealt with this objection already. The reason why for a person in the wintertime in Pennsylvania that ice is worth more in the summer is because there's a timing value of using the ice. It's just a more valuable experience to sit out on your veranda and sip iced tea in July in Pennsylvania than it is in February. It's just more valuable, right? We're not comparing equal satisfaction here. That's why this is no contradiction of time preference. Okay, so I just point those out just so we, again, see the fundamental argument that's being made about time preference. Now let's go on to the argument about the rate of interest. And we can depict this in a way that, a similar way to the way we did on Monday when we again talked about prices. And we did this top line, or this top analysis. Here we're starting down here first, and we're saying people have time preferences. And of course their time preferences can differ with respect to their intensity. So we can have some people with low time preference, and we can have other people with high time preference. And the people with lower time preference then would be willing to accept a payment, a future payment for lending present money that was smaller than the payment that the high time preference people were willing to pay. So we would have borrowers who are willing to pay high interest premiums to borrow present money and lenders willing to accept lower premiums. And so naturally they can make mutually advantageous trade. So this is where we get the demand and supply of present money, right? That's this arrow. And just like with our discussion about prices on Monday, We see that both demand and supply come into existence because of our preferences and nothing else. There's no other consideration here. They're just preferences. Well, I guess there is, technically, there is one other consideration, right? The other consideration is there are particular objective features of the situation of acting. And then, you know, remember we used the example on Monday when we were talking about prices of used iPad 2s. So there's a certain number of used iPad 2s that people possess, and they have knowledge of each other and so on, so they get together on eBay and they trade. But there are no considerations except their subjective valuations of the iPads. Same thing here. There's no consideration except for time preference that is behind what we call the pure rate of interest, the little r in my schematic. So they're just people who are willing to part with present money to accept a payment, an interest payment, that's lower than other people are willing to pay to obtain the present money. Low time preference people and high time preference people. So that's how we get, this is the basic argument about the interest rate. And notice it's demand and supply for present money. We'll talk more about this in due course. What's being exchanged in the, what we call the time market, what's being exchanged in the credit markets and other parts of the time market, is present money for future money. By the way, we know this is true just by looking at the world, right? We just look at the world, and you go to get a loan at a bank, and you don't trade apples or tons of steel or automobiles. You don't trade consumer goods or producer goods. You trade money. You trade the medium of exchange. All lending and borrowing is done in money. Forward transactions are always in goods, right? There are no forward transactions in the same money, trading dollars for dollars in the future. That's because dollars are always equivalent to dollars in exchange value in the future, right? This is the reason why you can isolate the time preference factor with money. And that's why money is used in making exchange of present money for future money, because the timing value of money is extracted. It's not part of this exchange. Whereas it would be if we traded goods, right? Present oil, if we traded it intertemporally for future oil, the future price could either be higher or lower than the present price. But for money, this is never the case. The present price of money is always higher than the future price. Present money always commands a premium. Okay, so this is the argument. And then we want to chase down the rest of this. This is the basic argument we make. I'm going to chase down the rest of this. This arrow of causality says that the interest rate then is a determining factor of capital value. Now, for those of you who have studied economics or business accounting, this sort of thing, capital value are just asset prices. This is what we're referring to. This is our generic term for the asset price. So a factory would have capital value, a farm would have capital value. It would just be its market price. What investors are willing to pay for to buy the farm or the factory or the piece of equipment as an asset to use as a producer good in their production process. Or it could be a consumer good. Houses have capital value. Cars have capital value. Why is this? Because they generate their valuable services into the future. And so if you buy a car today and you expect to be using it 10 years from today, how much are you willing to pay today to get the services of that car 10 years from today? And the answer is, you're not willing to pay today the monetary value of those services to you 10 years from today. If those were $5,000, you're not willing to pay $5,000 today just to get back $5,000 10 years from today. You will discount that value by the rate of interest. So that's where the rate of interest bears upon asset prices. And again, you've been through the Austrian theory of the business cycle, you know that this is a critical feature of the business cycle theory. So monetary inflation and credit expansion suppress interest rates. If they suppress interest rates, they cause asset prices to go up. So the asset price bubbles are inherent in monetary inflation and credit expansion. They're just a necessary implication of this process that the Federal Reserve and other central banks go through. Okay, now let me also tie this all together up here again is what we did on Monday. We said people have preferences for different consumer goods, and so there's demand and supply, like the iPads and so on. And so the prices of the goods emerge, and then this value is imputed to the producer goods, so we have a marginal revenue product for the producer goods. And then we get rental prices for these producer goods or factors of production. But the rental prices are also discounted by the rate of interest, as long as there's a time element involved in the payment. So if an entrepreneur is paying his workers in advance of receiving the revenue from the output produced, then they will be paid a discounted value of their marginal revenue product, because the entrepreneur is essentially lending them money. He's fronting them the money before the consumers are recouping those values, right? Realizing those values in paying for the consumer good. And so our wages are discounted if we're paid in advance by the entrepreneur. And then the capital value, of course, will just be the sum of the rental prices. So if you, because those rental prices will be discounted. So this is a kind of a complete integration of this argument that we make, and the application then that it would have for topics you've already talked about, like business cycle theory. But we, again, want to dwell on this part of the analysis, just the interest rate part. Okay, so in doing that, the next step is just to distinguish between different, what we call parts of or component parts of the time market. The time market is all exchange that people make of present money for future money. But there are different venues in which this is done. On the one hand, there are credit markets. And credit markets are where people contractually make these exchanges. So a credit transaction is a transaction that contractually is not fulfilled until the future. So you take out a mortgage loan when you buy a house, and you sign the contract, and you get the $200,000 up front, and then you agree to the payment schedule over the next 15 years. And the contract is fulfilled when you make the last payment. So it's a credit transaction. So there are credit markets, and credit markets we could subdivide further into consumer loan markets and producer loan markets. And then we could, and of course, those would refer to the type of goods that are being bought with the borrowed money. And then we can further subdivide the consumer loan markets into the different types of goods that consumers buy. So there's the auto loan market, there's the mortgage market, there's the credit card market or general merchandise market, and so on and so forth. And then there are producer loan markets. So there are entrepreneurs who borrow, and again, they can borrow short-term or long-term, so there are commercial paper markets, and there are bond markets, and so on and so forth. So that's all covered in our analysis, right? We would just look at the world and see the objective features of it and say, oh, there's the AAA corporate bond market. How do we analyze that? That's part of the producer loan market. What determines the rate of interest? Well, one of the things that determines the rate of interest in AAA corporate bond market is time preference. And we'll get to the other things in a minute. Okay, so there are credit markets. That's one part of the time market. And the other major part of the time market is the capital structure. All production processes are part of the time market. This is because they all take time. And if they all take time, then someone has to front the resources that are being used in the present to produce the goods that will then have value only in the future. And that fronting of the resources, that putting of the value into the production process sooner and reaping the value later commands interest. So the lender will always require interest. And this rate of interest, remember, we're arguing, this is where we want to dwell upon this particular point. The rate of interest is determined by nothing but time preference. This is the argument that we're advancing. That's the point at which people sort of can't quite, it's harder to follow that would be the case. But just to see what it is that we're claiming, why that is a somewhat controversial kind of a claim among economists in the mainstream, what we're saying is that production itself has nothing to do with the rate of interest. It doesn't matter how productive we are or not. It doesn't matter if there's no production at all, in fact, since we know that consumer loans command interest, right? And there's no production there. I'm just borrowing from somebody else, and that person gives up a consumer good by not having the money to spend, and then I get to buy a consumer good that I like. That interest rate obviously cannot be determined by production. It has nothing to do with production. And yet the interest rate in the consumer loan markets is also linked to the interest rate in the producer loan markets. And the link occurs because, again, there's arbitrage of any value, significant value difference that exists between alternatives that are similar. So if I'm a lender and I can get in a producer loan of a similar structure, I can get an 8% interest payment, but in a consumer loan I can only get 4%, then I'm going to lend into the 8% market, and so are all the other lenders. But by supplying more credit into those markets, will push the interest rate down there, and by withdrawing the credit from the low interest rate markets, the interest rate there rises until there's no interest rate differential again. This again is just a general principle of what happens when we start to act towards some end. We start to use means toward the attainment of some end that we have. As we do this, we hit diminishing returns, and the value difference disappears. So the same thing is happening in society. The same thing is happening in financial markets. This interest then, this what we might call the pure rate of interest, this little r, what Mises called the originary rate of interest, the interest rate that's based just upon time preference, is a payment for the value of advancing people in time. That's all. And production, again, doesn't affect this, at least not directly. To put this in a somewhat different way, the interest rate is not set by demand and supply in the credit markets. Demand and supply in the credit markets is determined by time preference. It's not sort of independently set by demand and supply. By the way, this is the same argument we made about the prices of goods in general. We said the price of, on Monday we used the example, the price of the iPad 2 is $300, and that $300 is the price that clears the market, but it isn't set by demand supply as an independent factor. Demand and supply, in turn, are themselves determined by nothing more than our preferences. Demand and supply for credit are determined by nothing more than our time preferences, and therefore they're just manifestations of them, right? They're just the manner in which we act with respect to our time preferences in these markets. It's also true that the interest rate doesn't equate saving and investing. That's just not quite the right way of thinking about this whole issue. Right? Time preference determines both saving and investing and the rate of interest. It isn't that they're independent of each other. So it's not like we have capital markets and we have, savers and investors, and somehow this market can get all out of whack or something. In the unhampered market, this would not be the case. I'm not saying the government couldn't set price controls or something and push it out of whack, but if we're left to act on our own devices, then these things are always harmonious with one another. Right? They're always in sync with one another, because that's how our preferences are satisfied. This is the manner in which we satisfy our preferences. We might even say that not only does interest, this pure rate of interest and time preference, permeate all of these different activities of lending and borrowing, but interest would also exist even in imaginary constructs. So during the week, you've talked about the evenly rotating economy. This is the fictitious economy where all underlying factors that generate changes in the patterns of production and exchange and consumption are assumed away, and so the patterns of production just rotate over and over in the same patterns over time. Some people die and other people are born, and the people who are getting older just take the place of the their preferences just take the place of the people who are passing away, and the younger one, you know, the three-year-olds now, their preferences are taking the place of the guys who were three-year-olds last year, and they're four-year-olds, and they're taking place of the four-year-olds, and so on and so forth. Everything is just rotating over and over. There would be interest in that world. There would be no profit in that world, because profit is earned by the entrepreneur for superior foresight in anticipating changes. And that, of course, is the whole purpose of the imaginary construct of the evenly rotating economy, is to separate out interest from profit and to see that interest is based on other considerations besides uncertainty. That there's a basic fundamental component of interest that has nothing to do with uncertainty and would exist in a world of perfect certainty. Okay, so let's follow up on that point and talk about the relationship between interest and the other components of net income. So again, on Monday, we introduced this idea of net income when we talked about economic calculation, and you've heard this phrase used many times, and you know, you've elaborated on various applications of this idea of economic calculation. So gross profit or net income, I'm using those phrases interchangeably, is just the difference between the revenue that an entrepreneur earns from selling the output he's produced and the costs incurred by buying the inputs used to produce that output. And this net income has different sources. There are different productive contributions that the entrepreneur makes that earn the entrepreneur or group of entrepreneurs income, just like the workers earn wages from contributing the value of their labor services, and the landowners earn rents from contributing the productivity of their land, and so on. So we can conceptually, theoretically, we can break down net income into these four categories. And the four are, first, interest. This accrues to the capital funds that the entrepreneur invests in his own business. So if the entrepreneur saves and invests, he plows his past profit back into the business. Then for that capital investment, he earns interest. And he earns the same rate of interest as all the other similar investments would earn in the market economy. Now, he might also, though, provide entrepreneurial foresight in the real world. He could have superior foresight. By supplying that superior foresight, he earns profit, or entrepreneurial profit. He earns pure profit. So we have Tim Cook and all the guys and gals at Apple, and they introduced last year the iPad Mini. And I don't know if you guys have seen the sales figures on the iPad Mini, but contrary to what Steve Jobs thought, the iPad, the smaller size iPad, is wildly popular. So the sales of the regular iPads in 2012 was 58 million units. This year, the projections are that 88 million iPads will be sold, and 50 million of them will be minis, and only 38 regular size iPads. That took entrepreneurial judgment to see that, right? They anticipated this, and they provided the product. All the costs were incurred in advance. They saved and invested and plowed their past profit into the buying of the inputs, supplied the product. They earned interest on that investment, but then they earned profit above that for their superior foresight. And if they had inferior foresight, of course, they would suffer losses. Entrepreneurs can also supply labor. And if they do that, they would just earn wages, just like any other worker. So there can be implicit wages in net income. And quasi-wages is the term that Mises liked to use for what in economics we call leadership skills. And leadership skills, if we define them in an economic theoretical way, entrepreneurial leadership refers to the fact that some entrepreneurs are able to raise the productivity of other people who work with them. And that we call quasi-wages, the value of raising other people's productivity. The person who can do that can earn income from doing that. He can be hired to provide this skill and therefore earn income. And that income we call quasi-wages. So wages are earned for your own productivity and quasi-wages for inspiring other people, or however this is done, the charismatic guys and gals. They're able to raise the productivity of other people. So these are the components. So any particular business would have a net income, and we could do an economic analysis of it and see what component parts of it are attributable to their capital invested, their interest, their entrepreneurial foresight, whatever wages they might have earned by supplying labor or these leadership skills. Okay, now the other complicating factor we want to do with respect to the interest rate is this one, and then we'll spend the rest of the time talking about the critics. Any market rate of interest also can be broken down into components, and we've only talked about one of these components so far. That's the pure rate of interest. The pure rate of interest is that premium paid for present money that's based just upon time preference. And as we spoke about before, this pure rate of interest would be the same across all different types of lending of the same duration. So again, because our time preferences might have different intensity depending upon duration, we may have higher time preference the longer into the future or the later in the future our satisfaction is delayed. We could have an upward sloping yield curve, as they say in finance, right? Just based upon time preference. That would be possible, at least. But every loan that's of a 10-year duration would have the same pure rate of interest. We may not see it because it's embedded in differing market rates of interest of that same duration. The market rates would not have to be the same, but the pure rate would be the same. How do we know this is true? Because if it were different, there would be arbitrage, as we talked about before. There's no reason not to arbitrage if everything about the loans, two different loans are the same, if there's an interest rate difference. If the only thing creating the difference in interest rates is different time preferences, more intense in one place and less intense in another, then people will arbitrage that away. But that's not the only reason interest rates could differ between two different types of loans, right? There could be riskiness or uncertainty differences between different types of loans. So sometimes mortgage-backed securities are riskier, and so they command a higher interest rate. And lenders won't arbitrage that difference away for obvious reasons, right? There could be a price premium. The price premium comes from Cantillon effects. So you've heard some about that this week. When the government engages in monetary inflation and credit expansion, the new money goes into the hands of certain people. Not everyone uniformly, but just some groups in society. And those groups get to spend and have their preferences satisfied before other groups who will eventually get the money through the integrated process of spending and producing and so on in the market. And so the prices of the things that people who get the money early are buying will move up sooner than the prices of the goods that people who get the newly produced money later. And that increase in the price could show up in the net income of the producers of the goods who are producing these goods that are increasing demand earlier in the process. They could be earning extra net income that won't do them any good in the long run, right? But it shows up because their costs will also rise. But it shows up in net income. And it's not attributable to regular interest. It's not attributable to time preference. It's not attributable to uncertainty surrounding the loan. It's just a byproduct of monetary inflation. And then there can be changes in the PPM that people don't anticipate. So that, too, can enter into interest rates. So, mortgage rates right now, 30-year mortgage rates are 3 or 4%, somewhere between 3 and 4%. In 1979, they were 15% because we had 12% price inflation. So that gets embedded, as long as it's not perfectly anticipated, the change in the purchasing power of money would get embedded into interest rates. So this is our explanation then of how at one of the same time We can have a huge spectrum of interest rates for different types of loans in the economy, and yet we know that the pure rate of interest is the same across all these loans. We know this theoretically, right? Even though we would never see it empirically. Okay, now let's turn to the different arguments that are made about the interest rate, the critics of this theory. And let me just restate, I guess before I go to the slide, let me just restate what the pure time preference theory says and the particular pedagogical way in which this debate is usually offered. Bumbavork was the famous expositor of the critique of different theories of interest. And he gave us the pedagogy, and he said, the way in which to see this debate, the way in which to conduct this debate, is to pose what he called the interest rate problem. And the interest rate problem is this. Why is it that entrepreneurs do not bid the prices of capital goods up to the full value of the stream of their marginal revenue products? If they can buy a piece of equipment and it generates $1,000 in revenue each year for the next 5 years, why is no entrepreneur willing to pay $5,000 today to buy that machine? That's the interest rate problem. And the time preference answer to the interest rate problem is, it's because of time preference. Okay, so it's pretty straightforward. Right? It's time preference. We place a premium on present money, so we're not willing to give up $5,000 today just to get $5,000 back over 5 years. And we're assuming the purchasing power of the money is the same. So we're not dealing with that problem anymore. Okay, well, there are other attempted explanations, right? The Marxist explanation is the exploitation theory. And the exploitation theory says that interest is the surplus value, that the capitalist just extracts this because of his superior economic power. And the helpless worker, just either takes his job or starves, and so he accepts this discounting. And, of course, we won't go into the critique of the labor theory of value, but Bumbavork smashed this thoroughly. But we'll just point out these other considerations. Labor actually is paid its full value. It's paid its full marginal revenue product, discounted by time preference. And so if workers wanted to earn their full marginal revenue product, all they would have to do is agree to wait to be paid. Entrepreneurs would be fine with that. It doesn't make them any difference, right? That way they don't have to put their own capital up front to pay the workers. The workers just work for the next 6 months, and then at the end of 6 months, when the good is sold, they get paid, just like the entrepreneur would receive his profit. So that's, sure, the workers could earn their full marginal revenue product if they did that. Or, as I said in the last line, the workers could also earn their full marginal revenue product if they took their payment today, their wage, and then invested it, lend it out at the rate of interest. Then they would earn their marginal revenue product discounted, and they'd put it out on interest and earn the interest over the time that it takes to produce the good and sell the good, and they would have their full marginal revenue product. Of course, they don't do this. They don't do this because they have higher time preference. Okay, so that's the exploitation theory. We'll save questions till the end. They're productivity theories. I alluded to this earlier, that somehow interest is a manifestation of the productivity of capital. Capital generates some sort of physical productivity, and this inevitably gives rise to interest. There are famous examples of this in the economics literature, given by Frank Knight and Paul Samuelson, some famous neoclassical economists. And I'll just use this one. I've used this one about rice. So suppose you have 100 units of rice, and 1 year later it matures. You can, it blossoms into 110 units of rice. And it just does this every year. Every year you get a 10% physical increase in the amount of rice. And the conclusion is then that this is interest. See, the value of your real goods is growing over time because of productivity, and that's interest. But you can see right away that this physical productivity of the capital good, or whatever the thing is not interest. It's not referring to the same phenomena as interest. It's just referring to the physical productivity of the good. So, for example, let's suppose that you could buy rice. Let's suppose we had a market, and you could buy this 100 units of rice that automatically matures into 110. Then the question is, what price would be paid? What would be the value of this productivity? What would capitalists be willing to pay to buy the 100 units of rice? Now, if we assume that this is a perpetuity, that this increase of 10% occurs perpetually, and if we price each unit of rice at a dollar, so I'm just you know, posing that so we can do the calculation, then the capital value of the rice would be given by this formula. It's the marginal revenue product divided by the rate of interest, whatever it is. So if we had a $10 marginal revenue product, right, that's the 10 additional units of rice. We go to 110 from 100. Each unit of rice has a price of a dollar, so that's a $10 increase. Right? And then every year we're going to generate a $10 increase. If the interest rate happened to be 10%, then the price that would be paid for the 100 units of rice would be $100. Because that would be what you would pay to get a 10% return. You'd get $10 on $100 invested. Now, what if the general interest rate, though, in the economy fell to 5%? Then would investors be willing to pay $100 to get a $10 return each year? No, clearly no. They would bail out of this investment, and they would only, in order to invest, you'd have to be willing to pay $200 to get this. I said bail out. I mean, they would go into this investment, right? Sorry, they would go into this investment, and you see, that's why I don't speculate myself. So they would flock into this investment because they can get 10% here, but 5% everyplace else, and they would bid the capital value of the 100 units of rice up to $200. And so the exact same physical productivity would generate a return of 5%. So the only way that these examples work is if you assume that the goods are not traded. Then it sort of poses a problem. But once you see that if they're traded goods, well, this would necessarily have to happen. They would have to adjust, in other words, the capital value would adjust to make the rate of return on this investment the same as every other investment. You know, the famous example of the taxi medallions in New York City. It's just a case of this, right? So you have a limited number of taxi medallions, and at first they cost $100 or something in 1948 or whenever they started. And today, in order to buy one, because the value of you know, providing the taxi service through this cartelized system is so high, the value is like $250,000 or $500,000. So the rate of return you get is exactly the same as the rate of return on anything else. It's no benefit over time to get these privileges from the state. Okay, there are eclectic theories. This is a neoclassical theory. And the neoclassical theory, just like we talked about on Monday for prices, says that the interest rate is mutually determined by two factors. One is time preference that determines the demand for borrowed money, and the other is the productivity of capital that determines the productivity of capital determining the demand. So you have investors who look at the productivity of capital and say, oh, I want to invest in this and that and this and that and the other thing, and so they're willing to demand a present money. And then you have people with time preference on the other side supplying the present money. But perhaps, again, we'll just reiterate these arguments that I suggested about this way of approaching the problem on Monday. This violates the ends-means causal chain. It just can't be the case that value is independent in the productivity of capital, somehow affecting, independent of the ends that people are pursuing, the rate of interest. It has to be flowing from our ends to our means and not, again, independently from the means to the ends. This also involves the fallacy of the vicious circle, because as we showed before, this can't mean physical productivity. We've already debunked that. It has to mean value productivity. But in order to calculate the value productivity of capital, I need to know the interest rate. But that's what I'm saying is being dependent. So I'm, now again, the neoclassical economists would say, well, we're not subject to the vicious circle because we don't believe in cause and effect analysis, and we're just going to do simultaneous equation analysis. Well, that, okay, so that gets us into a whole other set of arguments that we won't pursue here. So I mentioned that just as an aside. There are problems with that approach as well. Bumbabrook's theory looks like this. He says that time preference itself is determined by value productivity of capital and what he calls subjective factors. He thinks that we have a irrational predisposition to overvalue present things. Just as an example. But again, you can see the problem with this. The problem is that the value productivity, Bumbabrook, by the way, is a cause and effect theorist, so the value productivity of capital can't be known until we know the interest rate. And so it can't be in this, in the beginning line of cause and effect. It just, it's again, it's a vicious circle. Now, this is another theory that you find in the neoclassical school. This is called the theory of weighting. And their argument is that weighting is a factor of production. And so it doesn't get competed away, so to speak, right? It doesn't get bid away by the capitalists. This solves the interest rate problem because it's just like a factor price like any other. So this is really the denial that there is any difference between the value of the output and the value of the inputs once you take weighting into account. Now, what is the problem with this argument? Well, part of the problem is in how this argument defines weighting. So you know, normally we would think of weighting as just waiting. It is like we normally think of weight, like I sit and wait for my lunch to come or whatever. But here, waiting means supplying present money. So it's just equivalent with supplying present money. Well, but we've already said, right, and this argument would admit that supplying present money is based upon time preference. And so you can see that this waiting doesn't add anything to the argument. This is just saying people have time preference and so they supply present money. And that helps determine the rate of interest. That's all this is saying, right? That's just, it doesn't really help us. It's superfluous, really, to talk about weighting. The other problem, and here I'm not going to explicate this. I'm going to rely on some of you know about this argument, and so this will make sense to you and others don't. So we don't have time to actually develop this. But the marginal productivity theory of factor pricing, you cannot apply to weighting. Right, this theory says that the way an entrepreneur determines his demand for the factors of production is he removes a unit of the factor of production and then sees how much output falls, and then he values that decline in output, and then he says, that's what that unit's worth to me. But you cannot do this with supplying present money, because the marginal physical product of supplying present money is the rate of interest. It's the additional revenue that you get from adding an additional unit of output of this input. And so it doesn't even make sense to approach the problem this way, right? Bob Murphy has some criticisms of the pure time preference theory that we can quickly address. He says there's actually a dilemma in this argument from two different definitions of time preference. And it's true semantically that this problem exists, but we can clear this up, as I think I've shown in the presentation, just by not making the semantic confusion. He says time preference is sometimes referred to as a present satisfaction over a future one, and sometimes as present goods over future goods. Okay, well, that, if you define it in the latter sense, certain difficulties emerge because, as we pointed out before, present goods won't always command a premium over future goods because of the timing value of goods. And once you recognize that, then this dilemma falls away, right? We can avoid both horns of this dilemma. It's not problematic. It's the same thing for his second point. He says time preference as a satisfaction is neither necessary nor sufficient to get a positive premium on present goods. That's true, because present goods could differ from future goods because of a difference in the value of timing, as in addition to time preference. But this isn't true, again, for money. For money, present money always commands a premium over future money. And so, again, this is not a telling argument. And finally, Guido Holtzmann offers two criticisms. And again, these are, in my judgment, just semantic problems that we cleared up at the very beginning of the talk by making the distinction between valuing timing and time preference. So Dr. Holtzmann points out that that Mises makes two contradictory claims about interest. He says, a larger stock of a future good is preferred to a smaller stock of a present good, of the same good in the present. But then Mises also says that a present good and a future good are two different goods. Okay, that is a problem. I agree. But interest doesn't have anything to do with that, as I suggested before. It refers only to money. It only refers to exchanging present money for future money. And once you recast the argument that way, then it doesn't fall prey to this difficulty. And it's a similar thing for his second point. He says, time preference is a difference between options, a choice for the same good, the same satisfaction, right, in the present versus the future. But interest, he says, Mises words it, is two different sets of goods. It's present goods and future goods. But once again, this objection... Is bypassed by pointing out that the exchange is always in money. It's not a different good. It is the same good. It's money in the present or money in the future. And so this isn't a logical conundrum that he presents. All right, at that point, I'll stop and that will be it.